Well, I have said several times in the Sermon on the Mount series that we've been doing on Sunday morning that Jesus' role in coming to the Jews was not that of a law changer, but rather of a law keeper. I want to keep pressing that point a little bit in a little bit different way. Introduce that by saying several months, actually a year, maybe a little more than a year ago, I was in another adult class in another congregation, no names, but they were talking about Jesus, and there was a study in one of the New Testament Gospels there, and someone had made a comment in the class and said, well, Jesus was a rebel after all. It was kind of a matter of fact statement, like, well, this is true and everyone knows this, and it just shocked me, and it really bothered me. And I kept thinking to myself, is this true? Did people really think that? Was he really a rebel? And you know, what does that say about him? And that statement really gnawed at me and forced me to respond. So this is the response, okay? I didn't get it then, but I'm going to give it to you now, even though you weren't there. And if there's anyone listening to this lesson here, whether you're here or listening to the recording, if you think that Jesus was a rebel, I challenge you in hearing this lesson to think again. Let me say, too, that we tend to view Jesus through our 21st century perspective, and we need to see him in his natural setting to understand what he said and why he said it. In other words, we need to understand him in his biblical, historic, and prophetic context. And that takes more effort to do that, by the way, because usually we tend to take the path of least resistance. We listen to what people tell us. We take our traditional views, and we don't try to challenge those. I'm not here to purposely challenge traditional views. It's not my role. But I am trying to tell you that if we have traditional views that are unbiblical, those need to be challenged and cast out if indeed they are found to be wanting. So this lesson, as I said, ties directly in with our morning series on the Sermon on the Mount. I do believe that many Christians do think Jesus came to change the law of Moses and thus disregarded what was written and was actually overwriting, as he spoke, overwriting new laws as if he was in conflict with Moses, actually laying down church law in the middle of the Mosaic law. And there's just right there you have some conflict with how in the world can that be. I did give a lesson here several weeks ago, actually a month and a half ago, Fulfilling the Law and the Prophets. If you want to hear more on that, I invite you to do so. And in that lesson, I went over Matthew 5, verse 17 through 19 that Mike read for us here, and to remind us in this lesson of what Jesus had said about himself and about keeping the law. Galatians 4, verse 4 also says that Jesus was born under the law. You can't change what you're born under or in submission to, which is what that means there, without becoming a violator of that thing. If Jesus changed the law of Moses, then he's a lawbreaker, not a lawkeeper. And therefore, he is unworthy to be our sacrifice, to be our Savior, because there are just so many problems with him then. But then we come back to this other gnawing problem, when that is, how do you regard this, you have heard it said, but I say unto you, type phraseology that you have in Matthew chapter 5. It does sound like a rebel up front, I'll give you that. It does sound like a revolutionary statement. So we want to deal with that. First of all, what I want to do is take you to, you know, really what rebellion is. I mean, a lot of people haven't really stopped to think about what it is to be a rebel. Rebellion means open opposition to law, a refusal to abide by an established government or authority. And there are different manifestations of that refusal to obey. I'm going to give you three of them here just for the sake of our lesson. There is the romanticized view, and romanticized doesn't mean what you might think of romantic. It means imaginary or visionary or cool, okay? And that's often what people think. You know, this tough anti-authoritarian figure who is admired by those who feel stifled and oppressed and discriminated against by their parents, by the law, by the churches, by demand, you know, or whoever it is that is oppressing you. You know, there's just someone out there, some kind of force that's out there keeping you from doing what you want to do. If anyone's ever seen Footloose, you know what I'm talking about, okay? So young people tend to think that, you know, they're cool and they're expected to rebel against authority and the establishment and often want to take matters into their own hands. I'm not saying all young people here think that. I'm saying young people in their youth tend to think that way. And they tend to view also that anyone or anything that keeps them from doing what they want to do and however they want to do it and whenever they want to do it, that seems so unfair and oppressive. So the romantic rebel is someone who is willing to take his stand against that authority, talk back to it, show unapologetic disregard for law and authority and God himself, just so that he can live as he pleases without somebody telling him no. And because that's really what this is all about. Someone's telling you no, and you feel like, well, you know, I don't feel like that's fair. I should be able to do this if I want to. And, you know, there's that oppression that you perceive anyway. And, you know, here comes a hero. The romanticized rebel is a hero in the eyes of those people. So many people admire and support and encourage such behavior, and those people become rebels in themselves. Even though they're not doing the same thing, outwardly, actively, they are certainly supporting that. Well, that's one kind of rebel, but here's another kind of rebel, and that's the criminal rebel. Here's a person or people who seek power, control, money, and illicit gain. It's kind of like it goes from any level here. You can start with a neighborhood bully, but you can also go to like a drug lord or warlord or leader of a military coup against a peaceful government, insurgent fighters, etc. You hear them all the time in the news. You hear about them going on in Africa with ISIS, just about any third world country. This is always happening. You've got these people who are trying to take over. And these people are seeking at one level or another to destabilize the status quo or destabilize the society that they live in order to establish a new world order in which they are greatly benefiting and from which they will greatly profit. By the way, I don't want to get into it here, but this is happening even in our country. It's happening under the current of popular mainstream dialogue and consciousness, but it's happening nonetheless. You have people doing this right here in this country. And these people have no respect for law. They have no respect for authority, and often they have no respect for human life. And it's not because, like in the romanticized view, they feel stifled and oppressed, but they're controlled by greed. They're driven by greed and financial gain and self-gratification. They have an agenda. It is purely self-serving and evil. They don't care that they're wrong. They always profit at someone else's expense. They are abusive. They are oppressive. This is basically merciless thuggery, okay? It's really what we're talking about. Morally responsible, law-abiding people condemn such criminal activity, of course, and yet such people always seem to garner some kind of support. People who will follow these individuals, noble admirers, you might call them, who wish that these people would change the system so that they also would be able to profit from that. So there's, by that complicity, by that association, these people are also rebels. And there's a third kind of rebel, which might be more admired by you, for all I know. This is one who stands up to an existing authority, because he believes that it is unlawful and unjust and refuses to serve the best interest of the people. This is typically a person who will be an advocate of political reform, social justice, and limited government involvement. Ideally, he is not self-serving because, again, ideally, he seeks the good of society, not just a few disenchanted people or his own generation. Often we call these people revolutionaries because that's what you see in a revolution, is that kind of attitude, not always, but often. And that does require, even in a revolution that sounds good, there is still rebellion there. You have to be a rebel in order to be a revolutionary, because you are going against the existing powers, the powers that be, the laws of the land. I'll reread my definition of rebellion: open opposition to law, or refusal to abide by a standard or established government or authority. So if you think about the American Revolution in the late 18th century, this would be a clear example of what we're talking about here. The American colonists felt that the British government was being unfair, unjust. They couldn't tolerate it anymore. They decided to rebel, to revolt, and to be revolutionaries in that very true sense. And they declared their independence there, of course, in 1776. Near that same time, we had the French revolutionaries who also in the late 18th century actually executed their own monarch, King Louis XVI, and established a republic instead. These kind of things are often controversial because there's two sides to this and there's a lot of different factors involved. I'm giving you an extremely simplified view of this. There is certainly more to say on that. It's also true that sometimes good does come out of all this that we didn't expect. The American Revolution led to the Declaration of Independence and then ultimately the United States Constitution, which I will just say on a personal note from what I understand of it is one of the most brilliant documents to have ever been written by men. It's just an absolutely fascinating achievement. Okay, but that came out of this rebellion, this revolutionary act here. Even the French Revolution, though not as momentous, did produce what's called the Declaration of the Rights of Man, which increased human rights and ultimately, because of what it taught, led to the abolition of slavery in that country. So I'm not saying the ends justify the means. What I'm just simply saying is that it's not a self-serving agenda. It's not just a couple of guys saying, hey, this is unfair. You know, I can't do what I want to do, so I'm going to rebel. It's not like that. And it's not criminal either in the sense of, hey, we're in it just for gain and personal profit and so on. There is a bigger, more noble picture involved than you would find with, say, a drug lord or a warlord. The question we want to ask, though, at this point is, which category, if any, does Jesus fit into? If we're going to just look at least these three general categories, is Jesus the romantic rebel? Is he against everyone suppressing his rights or suppressing his lifestyle? Anyone who's infringing upon him, suppressing his personal independence, is that where he's at? I picture the modern Jesus in this light here. The modern Jesus would be wearing a leather jacket. He'd have pierced ears. He'd have tattooed arms and neck, right? He'd have his hair overly gelled. He'd be smoking a cigarette, have a Bowie knife in his belt, and be sitting on a Harley Davidson. I mean, if you're going to go with that route, that's really what he would look like. Kind of a James Dean, you know, Jesus. And James Dean, does anyone know who that is? Okay. Lost some of the younger crowd there, but that's okay. You know, you have to ask, is that what you would consider Jesus to be? Or would you even dare to consider him a criminal rebel? Like, here's a man who's breaking laws and stepping on people and abusing and oppressing the system for his own personal profit, his own advantage, his own self-gratifying lifestyle. Obviously, that seems to be the furthest from our mind here, but understand, too, that when someone says in an adult Bible class that Jesus was a rebel and the class teacher doesn't stop him from saying that or doesn't correct him, there are people who might get that in their head. There might be people who think that, but that's okay. Or was he a Protestant rebel, a protester rebel, like Martin Luther? When I think of Protestant, when you think of Protestant, we tend to think of the Reformation. Martin Luther there in the 16th century and others who challenged the Roman Catholic Church and became known as Protestants, protesters, literally what the word means. Some people, by the way, call us Protestant because we're not Catholic. It's not true. You don't have to be a Protestant to be a non-Catholic. But some people see Jesus like that, like he's bucking the authority of the Pharisees and challenging the religious system of his day. Should we call Jesus a revolutionary because he sought rehabilitation and social and religious reform for the common good? Would that fit his persona? Would that fit what he did? Another way of looking at this that has nothing to do with rebellion or revolution is what I think is very much the case of Jesus. Jesus was not a rebel. He was not a revolutionary. He was a restorer. He was a restorer of the covenant relationship that the Jews had turned from and abandoned. I had talked about in a previous lesson this very verse here, Luke chapter 1, verse 16 and 17. It says, he, John the Baptist, will turn many of the sons of Israel back to the Lord their God. It is he who will go as a forerunner before him, the Messiah or Christ, in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers back to the children and the disobedient to the attitude of the righteous so as to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. What I said earlier in an earlier lesson, I say again, what John the Baptist began, Jesus continued and took to a whole different level. Jesus did not act as a revolutionary. He certainly did not act as a rebel. He acted as Israel's king, not as a breaker of the law, but a keeper of the law, because that's what the king does. He's a keeper of the law. And to reinforce that point, I'd like you to turn to Deuteronomy 17 with me, and we'll look at some verses here that talk about the king and his role and what God expected of a king of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 17 is in the Law of Moses. It is part of the five books that comprise what is officially the Law of Moses, or the Torah. And in verse 14, it says, "When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you and possess it and live in it, and you say, 'I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me,' you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses." In other words, this is a king that you don't choose on your own, but God will choose. So think about that in light of what is being said already. Consider this instruction in regard to Jesus, because remember, he was born king of the Jews. He was born to be a king, and God always recognized him as a king. And the first thing that is said is that the Lord your God is going to choose your king. And remember, Jesus, as being the Christ, is the anointed of God. That's literally what the word Christ means in the Greek. Christos, which means anointed or anointed of God, which is the same word from Messiah in the Hebrew language. Jesus was chosen and anointed of God. God chose him for this purpose. Secondly, it goes on to say in the next verse, "Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses," and so on. All right, well, so what's really being said here is that there should be no dependence upon the military strength of a foreign nation. And if you think about what Jesus did, is that he didn't depend on any foreign country. He certainly didn't depend on Rome. He didn't even depend on the military strength of the Jews, for that matter. He put all his trust and confidence as a king of Israel in God. And he taught that the Jews must also. We're going to get to that in our Sermon on the Mount series. Matthew 6, verse 33 says, "Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and God will take care of you." So that's what Jesus, as the king of the Jews, was teaching there. Not to go against that, but to comply with that. Verse 17 says, "He shall not multiply wives for himself, nor shall he multiply silver and gold for himself." Well, Jesus had no wife to turn his heart away from him, like Solomon and other kings did. He certainly was not a rich man. He lived in virtual poverty, so he didn't have gold and silver to tempt him one way or the other. So as far as his own personal life is concerned, he was wholly devoted, as a king should be, to the Lord. The next verse says that he shall write for himself a copy of the law in the presence of the Levitical priest. Well, the whole purpose of that statement is to remember what the law said and remember what the law taught. And yet Jesus knew the law perfectly and flawlessly and taught it to the priests and scribes instead of them teaching him. In fact, a case could probably be made that Jesus is actually the one who gave Moses the law rather than Moses giving Jesus the law. But that gets outside of our lesson. So instead of them overseeing his learning of the law, as would be the case of a typical king, he's the one who oversees their understanding of the law. He is the one who has the law in his heart, and he knows it, and he understands it, and he is a teacher of it. Look at verse 19 and 20 with me. "It shall be with him," the law that is, "and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, so that he and his sons may continue to long in this kingdom in the midst of Israel." What do you do with a statement like that to someone who says Jesus was a rebel? There's absolutely no way that you can say that because Jesus, in being a rebel, would be going against the very law that God laid down for the Jews, for the king. What Jesus would really be saying if he was a rebel is, "I'm not fit to be king." And yet God would make him king anyway. That just doesn't make sense. How in the world can you look at Jesus as a lawbreaker, a law changer, a revolutionary, an overthrower of the existing government in light of these passages? You know, throughout his ministry, Jesus, keep in mind, King of the Jews, revealed how the Jews themselves had strayed from the original covenant made 1,500 years before on Mount Sinai. Clearly, it was not Jesus who was the rebel. It was the Jews themselves who were in rebellion to God. Jesus is not the rebel here. It's the people who are the rebels. Let me show you what I mean by that. Turn with me now to Exodus chapter 20. This is the actual giving of the law. These are God's words, God speaking here in giving the Ten Commandments to the people. By the way, this is the premise for the entire law of Moses that the people agreed to and that the Jews were born under, just like Jesus was. Chapter 20, verse 2 and through 4 says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness on earth or beneath the earth or anything else. The Jews no longer bowed to idols after captivity. That cured them of that. But they certainly did idolize the Torah, the law itself. They idolized the temple, and they idolized their traditions. In fact, they lifted their traditions up to the same level as the law of Moses. So Jesus quoted Isaiah 29, verse 13 in Matthew chapter 15 there. He quotes, in vain do they worship me, teaching as their law the doctrines of men. So they were putting their own doctrines or their own precepts on par with God's law. Jesus isn't doing that. That's what the people are doing. It's not Jesus who's rebelling against the law or against the Ten Commandments. It is the people who are doing that. Remember that disregard for the law is also disregard for the lawgiver. Look at verse 7 here. It says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Well, the Jews profaned the name of God by their ungodly behavior. In fact, Paul even says later in Romans chapter 2, verse 24, says the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, you Jews. So it's not Jesus who's blaspheming the name of God. It's the Jews themselves who are the rebels who are blaspheming the name simply by choosing to live more like the world than they are God's people. Verse 8, Exodus chapter 20, verse 8, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. This was a law that was given to the Israelites themselves specifically. We have no record that this law was given, this injunction, this commandment was given to any other people. But the Jews turned what was meant to honor God into a multiple man-made laws and a source of oppression for the people. Anyone who reads the New Testament, anyone who reads the gospel accounts, see what the Jews did to the Sabbath. They turned it into a means of oppression for the people. All these commandments, you can't do this, you can't do that, you dare not, you know, violate the Sabbath commandments in any way. In fact, to the point where, you know, even if someone was hurting and suffering and came to the synagogue where Jesus was healing them, people were put out because Jesus was actually healing on the Sabbath. And you might recall a time when one of the Sabbath leaders actually said, there are 6 days in which to come to the synagogue to be healed. Let not you come on the Sabbath. Just think about that. And Jesus goes on to say, now wait a minute, if your donkey or your ox falls into the well, you're going to pull it out, but here's a man who's suffering on the Sabbath and you're not willing to let him be healed. Keep in mind also Jesus was Lord of the Sabbath, so he had every right to interpret what could or could not be done on the Sabbath. It's not Jesus who's the rebel here. It is the people who are in rebellion. Exodus chapter 20, verse 12, honor your father and mother that your days may be prolonged in the land where you're going. Well, the Jews chose to honor their traditions over their parents. Matthew 15, verse 3 through 6 gives us a clear case of that. And Jesus blasts them and says, you invalidate the word of God for the sake of your tradition. Now that is rebellion right there. That is rebellion. It's not Jesus who is in rebellion. It is the people who are rebelling against the very law that they consented to. Exodus chapter 20, verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. But of course, you know, because of our recent lessons here, the Jews freely divorced their wives in search of a better one. And Jesus referred to them in Matthew 16, verse 4, as an evil and adulterous generation, something that a certificate of divorce certainly could not prevent or overcome. Again, it's not Jesus who's rebelling against the law. It's the people who are in rebellion. Exodus chapter 20, rather, verse 15 says, you shall not steal. The Jews tithed mint and dill and herbs, but they robbed God of their faithfulness and honor. And they robbed the people of justice and mercy and compassion. Matthew 23, verse 23, Jesus points all this out here and other places as well. So there are some serious problems here with all of that, that the people, again, are being exposed for what they are as a bunch of rebels. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 16, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Well, the Jews were famous for manipulating words and of their vows and their promises. We had a recent lesson on that. They claimed to be holy, but as it were, they were willing to send an innocent man to his own death, especially his death on the cross, as they did to Jesus, based on contrived testimonies of false witnesses. And nobody, not even the chief priests or the scribes or the people that you would expect to stand up and cry for justice, nobody stopped that. In fact, they endorsed it. Who's the rebels here? It is not Jesus. It is the people. Exodus chapter 20, verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house and whatever else he owns there. But Jesus exposed the Jewish people as being filled with envy, jealousy, and greed. Many of the Jewish leaders and rulers actually believed in Jesus' words, but if you read John 12, verse 42 and 43 that I have up here, it says that even though they believed he was the Messiah, they dared not speak up because they loved the approval of men rather than God. They coveted the praise and approval of the people. What I just showed you was that Jesus is not coming and changing anything. Jesus is bringing the people back and exposing them for what they are. They're a bunch of frauds, at least those who are violating these laws. And we're just looking at the Ten Commandments. We're not even going into the rest of the law. They're a bunch of counterfeits. They're a bunch of hypocrites, as he calls them. They're a bunch of lawbreakers. They're rebels. It is not Jesus who is rebelling against the law. In any way, it is the people who have rebelled, and Jesus, as their king, is coming back and saying, this cannot continue any longer. You have got to get back to what is right and what you agreed to. Now, it goes outside this lesson to go this next point here, so I'm not going to even go there very long. At the same time, Jesus was looking forward in anticipation and in prophecy to a new covenant and to the creation of a new community known as the kingdom of God, where each citizen internalized all those ideals and characteristics and virtues that God had intended for Israel to have. This would be a better covenant because it would be enacted on better promises, a better ministry, and a far better king and high priest. I say that Jesus anticipated, don't read into that, that see, Jesus was changing the law to accommodate that. He didn't change the law at all. Remember Matthew 5, verse 17 through 19 that we first read, that Mike had read for us there, that says that Jesus says, until everything's fulfilled, nothing's changing. In fact, basically put a curse on anyone who would dare change it. So Jesus wasn't changing it to bring that about, but he simply said, it is coming. And on several occasions, you see that in the Gospels. It is coming. It is soon to be. It is almost upon us. And there's nothing wrong with him doing that. It would be no different from the Old Testament prophets saying the same thing. In the last days or in the days to come, there will be this new Messiah. Well, it wasn't happening yet, but it was going to happen nonetheless. But as I said, that would be another lesson. We just don't have time for that tonight. Think about a passage, like 1 Samuel 15, verse 23. We've been talking about this in our Wednesday night class. Samuel, the prophet, says to King Saul, the king of Israel, by the way, King Saul, he says, for rebellion, king, is as the sin of divination, and insubordination, which is refusing to be subject to law, is as iniquity and idolatry. And he goes on to say to Saul, because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you from being king. This is Samuel talking to the king of Israel who would not listen to God's commandments. And look at what he says to him. Just think of this passage in light of any claim that Jesus was a rebel, a revolutionary, a changer of the law. Think of what Samuel just said. He's saying that you are in rebellion. You are equal. This is rebellion is equal to witchcraft and sorcery and iniquity and idolatry. And saying that if any king is going to act like that, then he can no longer be king. And yet God would turn around and make this rebel Jesus a king. There's just no sense there. It's not only illogical, it's unbiblical. It's theologically untenable. It's just, there's nothing we can do with that except to reject it. So we must not accept any conclusion that puts Jesus in the same group with, well, divination, iniquity, and violators of the law or idolaters. Jesus didn't come to rebel against the law of Moses. But I want to be clear, he didn't come to lay down church doctrine either, because that's a lot of where people go with this. He came to expose the errors of his people, and he came to do that to awaken their conscience so that they would change and repent. And he came to remind them of their commitment to the covenant, their loyalty that was needed for that covenant, all to prepare them for what is coming, a new age in which there would be no more law of Moses, no more covenant with Israel, but there would be one covenant for all people to come to God through the Messiah, through Christ. Now, while he was on earth, that age had not yet begun. It couldn't begin until Jesus had died, been buried, resurrected, and then ascended to heaven, took his seat at the right hand of God. There's no way it could have come before that. Of course, that didn't happen in his lifetime. The Jews could hardly be prepared to enter into a new and better covenant if they had no regard for the existing covenant. And Jesus, as King of the Jews, not only had the ability to remind them of this, to force the issue, but also he had the moral responsibility to do so. Are you with me or are you not? Is really what he's saying to the people. Are you with me or are you not? And all of this begs a question. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this as we wrap things up here. It does beg a question about us. We have also entered into this new covenant that I just spoke of. And we are followers of the King, aren't we? Or are we compliant? Are we being compliant and submissive? Because if we're not being compliant and submissive, then we are rebels as well. That would make us rebellious to that covenant and to the King. I know that the world may think that we're rebels because we refuse to conform to the world and its backward logic and its moral depravity. In reality, we're providing light and salt to the world, that divine influence that is, you know, reflected out of us here, if you will, to expose the world's errors, to show a better way. The world doesn't see it that way, but that's not our point. Our goal must not be social reform, rescuing the economic or socially oppressed, better legislation, feeding the hungry, housing the homeless. These are things that revolutionaries often advocate, are advocates of, I should say, but that's not really our concern. We're looking for something far more important. We're looking for the salvation of people's souls. And that's something that the world can't do. The world can enact better legislation for housing and food and all that, but the world cannot save people's souls. And we can't either by ourselves, but we do have a message that will save souls. We do have a Lord that we can bring people to that will save their souls. But what if we ourselves are not living up to the terms and conditions of this new covenant? What if we become like the Jews, redefining holiness and righteousness and obedience to fit our chosen paradigm of what that means to us? Like when someone says, well, I'm a disciple of Jesus, but their word for disciple means far different than what Jesus actually meant. Or, yeah, I'm faithful to God, but their word for faithful is defined very differently than how God would define faithfulness. When we do that, we're not doing anything different than the Jews did, because they did the same thing, and they were famous for that. Now, that all requires another lesson, which I don't want to get into tonight, but this is what I want to leave you with, is this question. Are you being loyal to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords? And what would he say to you if he were here? If you say that you're being loyal, then would he agree with you? I hope that he would. I'm just going to give you a benefit of the doubt that he would, but what would he say? You know in your heart what he would say. And if there are changes that need to be made, what changes would there need to be made? And when are you going to make them, if necessary? Those are things we need to ask ourselves as we bring this lesson to a close. I hope this lesson was helpful to just simply underscore what we have been talking about, and we'll move on to other things as we move forward. If there's anyone here tonight that is subject to that lesson, to that invitation, we invite you to come forward as we stand and sing the song that Roy has selected for us here.